The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
Palace intrigue in Jordan. The king accuses his half-brother of trying to orchestrate a plot to overthrow the government. Jordanians are reacting to the family squabble with shock.
For us, we are not used to say any bad words or to accuse anyone of the royal family.
Also, on the Greek Isle of Lesbos, there are plans to build a better camp for migrants, but activists have questions about the location of the new one.
There is absolutely no connection to normality in that place, none whatsoever.
And Egyptian mummies make their way to their new home in high style.
It was more the Academy Awards than transferring 22 kings and queens.
All wrapped up with Somewhere to Go. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be back with you this Monday. We start today in Jordan, where a dramatic series of events is unfolding. Over the weekend, the government accused a former crown prince, Hamza bin Hussein, of planning, quote, a malicious coup. Prince Hamza denied the accusations in a video and said the Jordanian authorities have placed him under house arrest. For the U.S. and its allies in the Middle East, this is a worrying development. Jordan has long been a linchpin of stability in the region. And as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, all of this is happening at a time when Jordan's economy is struggling.
37-year-old Kamal has been following the news on social media. That's where he gets most of his news, he tells me, from his home in the Jordanian capital, Amman. And here's why.
I mean, at the same time, every major news channel, which is broadcasting from abroad, we're interviewing people from Jordan and we're talking about the subject. State TV had a documentary about the benefits of honey extracted from bees.
The media is tightly controlled, he says. Kamal himself fears speaking publicly about the royal family. That's why he asked me to only use his first name. What's been happening in Jordan in the past few days is rare. The kingdom has been politically stable for a long time. Disputes within the royal family are typically kept behind closed doors.
For us, we are not used to say any bad words or to accuse anyone of the royal family directly. So this shocked Jordanians a lot.
I'm making this recording today to try to explain what's happened over the last few hours.
This is the voice of Prince Hamza, half-brother of King Abdullah II, Jordan's current ruler. The government says Hamza has been involved in a malicious plot with foreign help to destabilize the country. In this video, Hamza denies that. He says he's effectively been put under house arrest and that his communication to the outside world has been cut off. He says he sent out this video on Saturday using a satellite phone.
Even to criticize a small aspect of a policy leads to arrest and abuse by the security services.
Prince Hamza formerly had the title Crown Prince, but in 2004, the king stripped him of that position and made his own son Crown Prince. Hamza is popular among tribal members in Jordan, according to analysts. He has been taking part in meetings with them in the past few months where, allegedly, people criticized government policies, specifically economic policies. Dalia Fahmi teaches political science at Long Island University.
The current king, when he came into power, he really focused on economic reforms and not on political reforms. So for the former crown prince, Prince Hamza, to critique his brother on economic mismanagement is really targeting what the king has been touting for himself.
Jordan's economy has been hurting a lot lately. Fahmy says. Corruption, mismanagement, the coronavirus pandemic have all played a role. And people are feeling the pain, says Kamal, the resident in Amman.
As Jordanian in general, we do support our king. You know, we do believe that there is no other solution outside the royal family. However, I do believe that Jordan as a state could have been run much better when it comes to the economic aspect.
Kamal has two young daughters, the ones you hear in the background. He says he pays taxes on baby formula. Prices of basic goods like cooking oil are way up. And the same with electricity.
At the same time, you know, we are now using online education for our kids. So what happens if you're not able to pay your bills?
Some 14 other individuals have been arrested in Jordan besides the former crown prince. Among them, Bassem Abdallah, a former cabinet minister and head of the royal court, and Sharif Hassan bin Zayed, a member of the royal family. But as bad the tensions in Jordan seem, Dalia Fahmy of Long Island University says it's unlikely that major political changes are imminent.
The continuation of the king is not what's in jeopardy here. It's really internal popularity, internal dissent, and whether the king will be able to accommodate this by some sort of set of reforms.
Meanwhile, Washington is watching all of this very closely. Jordan is an important ally for the U.S. in the region. The U.S. has military bases and some 3,000 troops there. On Saturday, a State Department spokesman said that King Abdullah has the full support of the United States. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
While we're in the region, prospects for the revival of the Iranian nuclear deal are showing some glimmers of hope. U.S. and Iranian officials are heading to Vienna tomorrow. Senior diplomats from the world powers that also signed the 2015 nuclear agreement will be there as well. Representatives from Iran and the United States will not be sitting down in the same room. Instead of talking face-to-face, discussions will be held via intermediaries. Ali Vaez is the Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group. Maybe you can give us a sense of how this will work, Ali. They'll be in separate rooms down the hall from one another with designated runners essentially passing long notes?
Yes, that's right. Basically, the remaining parties to the deal, that's Russia, China, UK, France, and Germany, and the European Union, those are the ones who will be going back and forth and trying to bridge the gaps between Iran and the US.
What does it say, though, that the US and Iran can't even sit at the same table at this point?
It is definitely an indication of how painstakingly difficult it's going to be to get back into full compliance with the deal. This is mostly because Iran and the US have mismatched expectations, and there's just so much mistrust between them. I mean, look, the end game here is pretty clear. Both sides want to get back into full compliance with the deal. It's just the sequencing and how that's going to work out that is going to be basically extremely complicated to agree upon. I fear one of the main obstacles to restoration of the deal would be an Iranian demand for verification of sanctions relief. The Iranian measures could be verified by the International Atomic Energy Organization, a neutral technical agency that is tasked with verifying Iran's compliance with its commitments. But there is no such institution in the world for verifying U.S. commitments and effectiveness of sanctions relief. And I'm afraid that would turn out to be a major issue that would stand in the way of restoring the deal.
I mean, the critics of the 2015 deal see gaps in it. They say it essentially leaves Iran's nuclear capabilities intact, that restrictions expire too quickly, and it does nothing about Iran's use of proxy militias and ballistic missiles. Those concerns are still there. Do you think new talks will address those issues?
Look, I think the Biden administration has already concluded that if it doesn't come back into the existing agreement, it would not be able to negotiate any kind of follow-on or broader agreements with the Iranians because the U.S. basically lacks credibility as a reliable negotiating partner. So first step is to restore the JCPOA as it was, and then the administration would have to convince the Iranians to agree to follow-on agreements. And I think they have a very powerful negative incentive for that purpose, which is the fact that the U.S. can turn its sanctions switch on and off to great effect on the Iranian economy, as it was demonstrated by the Trump administration. And so if a more for more or a better for better kind of arrangement is put on the table, it could be attractive to them.
One last thing, Ali. In 2015, when Iranian U.S. negotiators were in Vienna, they lived in a hotel for a month, struggling through daily negotiations before they finally got to the JCPOA. Does it help to be back in the same city with that recent history kind of lurking in the background?
I think it does, you know, because ironically, a lot of the people on the U.S. and on the Iranian side are the same people who negotiated this deal and spent an enormous amount of time in Vienna going through every single detail of this agreement. So I'm hoping that that reminds them that there is a win-win outcome at the end of this tunnel. And again, the alternatives to restoring the agreement as it was is just a lose-lose dynamic for both sides.
Ali Vaez is the Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group. Ali, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
In Honduras, many people are celebrating a criminal trial that wrapped up in New York City last week. Tony Hernandez, a brother of Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, was sentenced to life in prison for drug trafficking. The Hernandez brothers have both long been suspected of connections to organized crime. As the world's Jorge Valencia reports, a conviction in a U.S. court is raising all kinds of questions about corruption in Honduras.
In the days leading up to his brother's sentencing, President Hernandez posted a flurry of drug busts to his Twitter account. One was about a one-engine plane carrying cocaine, another about a pickup truck hauling narcotics. And when the federal judge in New York City sentenced the president's brother to life in prison for drug trafficking, President Hernandez wrote his government aggressively enforces the law and that his brother's trial was an injustice. But many Honduran citizens felt very differently. They celebrated with fireworks. Several dozen people wearing face masks gathered in the Honduran capital of Tegucigalpa. Most of them danced, a few waved Honduras's white and blue flag. In between songs, some would chant that President Hernandez himself would be next to stand before an American judge. People celebrated like it was Christmas or New Year's, explains Ramon Barrios, a retired judge and a professor of constitutional law at the National Autonomous University of Honduras. The conviction of Tony Hernandez for what federal prosecutors in New York called state-sponsored drug trafficking confirmed what many Hondurans had long suspected. And Barrio says it shows Honduran institutions' inability to hold those in power accountable.
Con mucha vergüenza que Estados Unidos, que Nueva York,
it is shameful, Barrios says, that justice is being served in the United States and not in Honduras. President Hernandez was implicated as a co-conspirator in his brother's case and two other federal cases in New York City. But the chances of that happening in Honduras?
No, descártelo.
No, you can forget about that, Barrios says. He explains that President Hernandez's government has been tainted by claims of corruption since before he was elected. Hernandez had previously served in Congress and was accused of stealing from government coffers to fund his presidential campaign. And once in office, Barrios says, Hernandez overstepped his authority by removing virtually all members of the Supreme Court, appointing close allies, and also appointing a member of his party as attorney general. Adrienne Pine is a professor at American University currently doing research in Honduras. She says that President Hernandez has allowed drug traffickers to freely operate.
There is sort of this chain of impunity for people who are implicated in carrying out violence on behalf of the current sitting president so that he can enrich himself and his colleagues.
And so independent watchdogs who seek to hold the Honduran government accountable have an uphill battle. Lester Ramirez is with the Association for a More Just Society in Tegucigalpa.
Of course, we're tackling right now corruption and justice. We also tackle security, human rights, studies on migration also.
All of which in Honduras is dangerous work. Activists are routinely harassed. Just 2 weeks ago, Carlos Cerros, a representative of the indigenous Lenca people, was fatally shot after opposing a new hydroelectric power station in his community. And 5 years ago, Dionisio Garcia was fatally shot after campaigning for the rights of women workers. Lester Ramirez says transparency advocates like himself have to be very careful.
In terms of learning how to be very, very protective of what you say, what you do, because we've had, you know, examples, you know, I've had personal experiences also. So, you know, you learn from those things.
Ramon Barrios, the constitutional law professor, says the consequences of this level of impunity and corruption in Honduras are far-reaching.
Yo veo que los Estados Unidos están quejando de la cantidad de inmigrantes, de hondureños sobre todo, que van hacia los Estados
Barrio
Unidos.
Barrio says the United States getting tens of thousands of asylum seekers every year from Honduras is a consequence of corruption in his country. And that, he says, is a problem that the United States can no longer ignore. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. On the Greek Aegean Islands, about 15,000 people live in refugee camps. The conditions? Unacceptable. That's the word the European Union's top migration official used during a visit to Greece last week. EU Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson announced €250 million, about $300 million, to fund five new facilities on the Aegean Islands.
It's of the utmost importance that we don't leave people in tents for another winter, and this is, of course, our common aim.
One of these new facilities will be built on the island of Lesbos, where about 7,000 people have been living in a temporary camp. The World's Lydia Manalidou reports there's resistance to the plans. And a quick note, asylum seekers asked to use their first names only for safety reasons and because they fear it might impact their asylum applications.
Migrants on Lesbos are allowed to leave the refugee camp for a few hours every week. Many come to this supermarket just down the street. They buy supplies and catch a break from conditions in the camp. Some hang out in the parking lot, and the little ones play. 16-year-old Murtaza from Afghanistan carries a six-pack of sodas. It's the last day of Nowruz, the Persian New Year.
And we are here to buy something for today.
To celebrate.
Yes.
What are you going to make?
Kebab.
Kebab?
Kebab, yes.
His parents will build a small fire and do the cooking in the camp. It's the second time they're spending the holiday on the island. They've been here for a year and a half. Across the street from the parking lot, taxis line up to take migrants further into town. Most people walk. An artist from Kabul heads to the offices of a local NGO where he's teaching art classes. Other people make their way to doctor's appointments. A small group of Afghan women wait for the bus with their kids. They tell me that at the camp, NGOs give them diapers for the babies, but
no baby food.
No baby food.
20-year-old Morsal is one of the women heading into town to buy supplies. Morsal is about 5 months pregnant and has a toddler. As we chat, he starts crying and knocks the microphone out of my hand. She says her baby is cranky because he has not been able to sleep. The tent they live in is right by the sea, and at night, it's too loud.
She is cold and...
Because of the wind?
Yes, wind. Yes, wind.
She acts out how her baby was crying all last night. Everyone here tells me the conditions at the camp are not good. But at the very least, the site is close to the port city of Mytilini, and people can walk to places and services. You cannot say the same for the area where the new EU-funded camp will be built. It's about 20 miles north of here. To get to this remote part of the island, I have to rent a 4x4, drive through unmarked dirt roads and over deep puddles. Greek officials say they chose this location because it's so remote.
It's in the middle of nowhere.
I travel with Violeta Dimitrakopoulou, a local activist and researcher, and with Katie Fallon, another journalist.
So we think this is it?
We think it's literally a rubbish dump.
After a bumpy ride, we reach the landfill that the camp will be built next to.
Oh!
This is, as Fallon put it, literally a rubbish dump. So the smell is overwhelming.
So they're just trash everywhere, seagulls feeding on it. The smell is really intense.
We drive around the area, but there's not much else to see. The landfill is surrounded by untouched forest. Work on the camp is expected to begin in the summer, and the goal is to finish it by the end of the year. Officials say the conditions will be better for migrants and for locals on the island.
If they're gonna move the people here, it's gonna be very, very hard.
Officials say people will still be able to move in and out of the camp in a controlled way. But, Violeta Dimitrakopoulou says,
where the people should go? In the forest.
and do what?
I mean, what a way to disconnect a whole population from the local people. I mean, there's going to be absolutely no chance for integration. And also, just as a person living there, there is absolutely no connection to normality in that place, none whatsoever.
Back in town, Georgia Mitsika tells me she's more optimistic. She manages all Lesvos operations for International Rescue Committee. It's an NGO that offers mental health and other services in Mytilene.
Of course, we want people to be close to services, but we will support them anywhere.
She says her main concern is that people live in adequate conditions. Others say better facilities are not the answer for migrants. Clotilda Scolamiero is with Intersos, another NGO on the island.
What I'm afraid the most is that they want to create a facility that seems to be more human.
She says a camp with showers, electricity, containers rather than tents might seem better, but ultimately it'll be what she calls a golden prison. She and her organization are against refugee camps altogether.
We believe that the European Union should manage the migration in a completely different way, like towards integration, not towards confinement.
Back at the supermarket, many people tell me they haven't heard about the new camp, and those who have say they do not want to be moved there. The bus that the group of Afghan mothers are waiting for arrives. As they struggle to squeeze their strollers into the crowded bus, I ask about the new camp.
New camp?
Yeah.
No, me go Germany, America, France.
They laugh and tell me that by the time it'll be built, they hope to be in Germany or France or really anywhere else. For the world, I'm Lydia Emanoulidou, Lesvos, Greece.
Okay, do you remember the last time you went to the movies and what you saw? For me, it was Amazing Grace, the Aretha Franklin concert film. That was more than a year ago. Theaters worldwide are opening up again, and this weekend drummed up some big business.
We need Kong. The world needs him.
Godzilla vs. Kong opened last week and smashed expectations, with the biggest opening at the domestic box office since the start of the pandemic. According to The Hollywood Reporter, the film had taken in more than $280 million worldwide as of Sunday. Here's a question, though. Is it safe to go out to the movies?
Unfortunately, for most people, should still stay away from movie theaters. And it breaks my heart to say that.
That's Saad Omer, an epidemiologist and the director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. For the most part, he says people should remain cautious, especially in areas where there are still lots of cases of COVID-19.
The exceptions are that if everyone is vaccinated and there is the ability to distance, that is okay.
For most people in the U.S. and Europe and many other parts of the globe, that's not yet the case. However, there are some creative solutions to getting in your movie fix. Drive-ins had a bit of a renaissance over the summer. Some theaters are renting screening rooms to groups. Omer says that's a great option for a vaccinated party. He also added this won't be the state of affairs forever. Soon enough, movie theater guidelines will be relaxed.
I miss the overpriced popcorn and chicken tenders. And the most I miss the visceral experience of that big, you know, woofers and subwoofers. There's a vibration in the movie theater. You cannot replicate that at home. So once things become safe, I really, really look forward to going back to the movies.
Saad Omer, I am right there with you. It's the world. As the world inches closer towards something resembling normal, transportation planners want us to remember trains and buses.
Can you imagine surviving 2020, you know, only to face all the problems we faced before and adding a mobility crisis if everybody drives to work?
Also coming up, Bibi Netanyahu in the courtroom. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Across the U.S., in private homes, there are more than 2 million people working as nannies, housekeepers, or health aides. Many are people of color or immigrants. They can and do face exploitation, even abuse. Early evidence shows that during the pandemic, the problems have only gotten worse. But activists say they've made a breakthrough to increase protections. And as The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, they're getting a hearing on an international stage.
Many victims of trafficking don't realize that's what's happening to them. Sam didn't until he saw a crime drama on TV about a situation like his.
NCIS, that's how I learned about it.
We're only using Sam's first name because he's worried something he says here will affect his U.S. visa application. 8 years ago, in the Philippines, his mother went into debt to pay an agency to send him to the U.S. and set him up with a job. But when he got to L.A., he found himself stranded and alone, sleeping on the couches of strangers.
I didn't have a place to go, so I was like going from one house to another.
Sam worked long hours for little pay as an in-home health aide. He says he experienced physical abuse, sexual harassment, and bullying. When he complained, his employers threatened to report his undocumented status to immigration authorities.
You don't have a choice. You suck it up because it's the only way that you'd survive.
Sam had no choices, even though what happened to him is unfortunately common and was well documented long ago. In 2007, six women who worked for diplomats in Washington, D.C. and New York took their cases to the American Civil Liberties Union. They said they had been physically abused, sexually assaulted, and denied medical care and even sufficient food to eat. The U.S.-based diplomats from Botswana, Bangladesh, Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile had diplomatic immunity and could not be charged for treating the women as virtual slaves. The ACLU went to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in D.C. It's a regional organization within the United Nations for countries in this hemisphere. Claudia Flores was one of the ACLU lawyers arguing the U.S. had failed to ensure human rights and protect these domestic workers.
Part of the purpose of the commission is in situations just like this, where there is a problem that's affecting a vulnerable community, that the vulnerable community has tried to bring it to U.S. courts and that U.S. courts haven't addressed it and our Congress has not addressed it.
The U.S. responded to the ACLU's complaint in 2016, arguing it should be dismissed. The U.S. said it had revised, expanded, and strengthened its policies to protect domestic workers. That included providing information about trafficking to workers coming into the U.S. and keeping copies of their contracts with employers on file. Despite that, last summer, the Inter-American Commission members made a decision in the workers' favor. They ruled the ACLU could petition for a hearing on behalf of all domestic workers in the U.S., not just those employed by diplomats. And a few weeks ago, the ACLU and Flores, who's now at the University of Chicago, did just that.
So the brief we just filed essentially argues that the United States excluded domestic workers from most labor and employment protections.
They've asked for a hearing as soon as next month.
This is the first petition of any kind that's been brought on behalf of domestic workers against the United States within any international system.
Flores says she hopes the commission will eventually issue an opinion about what actions the U.S. must take to protect domestic workers. That judgment would not be binding. U.S. participation is voluntary. But activists say the bigger win here may just be holding the U.S. accountable on an international platform. It raises the issue's exposure, just as the U.S. Congress is set to consider legislation to establish a national domestic worker bill of rights, a bill Joe Biden supported as a candidate for president. It was proposed by then-U.S. Senator, now Vice President, Kamala Harris.
It includes fighting for paid sick leave. It includes fighting for child care relief. It includes fighting for hazard pay.
So that's very exciting that we have a real champion for domestic workers in the White House.
Anna Duncan is at the National Domestic Workers Alliance. It's lobbying members of Congress for their support and to bring the bill up for debate in May or June.
The petition and the actions from the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, you know, really can serve as a way to pressure the U.S. government to take the steps necessary to make sure that domestic workers' rights are protected.
I contacted the State Department for this story, and a spokesperson sent me an email that says the administration continues to implement policies and promote practices aimed at protecting this vulnerable group of workers. Sam, the worker at the beginning of this story, eventually escaped the trap of trafficking. He says he was taken in by a retired Filipino-American man, and he's grateful. They contacted a community organization that's now helping Sam apply for legal status.
Instead of being kind of angry, I'm just thankful that I did survive.
Sam tells me he's still hoping to pay his mom back one day, and he wants her to know that everything she sacrificed to send him to the U.S. was worth it. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
It's not often you see a head of state go on trial while still in office, but in Israel today, that is precisely what's going on. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's motorcade pulled up to the Jerusalem District Courthouse this morning, where he's facing charges of corruption. Outside, hundreds of people protested for and against Netanyahu. This comes just 2 weeks after the country's fourth national election in 2 years. Joining me from Tel Aviv is The World's Ariel Osaran. As we pointed out many times on the show before, Ariel, this is not the first time Netanyahu is appearing in court on a range of corruption charges. What is different about this time?
Today, it really kicked off with the beginning of witness testimonies. Now, today we heard from the first witness. His name is Ilan Yeshua. He was the chief editor of the Walla news site that's at the center of this case. So Yeshua described hundreds of demands for positive coverage sent by email, phone calls, and texts. And all these demands were sent on behalf of Netanyahu and his wife, Sarah, and were delivered through messengers.
So that's some of the most toxic charges. Remind us what some of the other charges are.
Netanyahu is charged with three main counts of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in three different cases that were consolidated into one mega case. In one case, Netanyahu was charged with receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of gifts from wealthy friends. And in another, he's accused of trying to orchestrate positive media coverage with the head of Israel's main newspaper. The third and most serious case, which was at the focus of today's hearing, alleges that Netanyahu backed legislation worth hundreds of millions of dollars to an Israeli telecommunications mogul. In return, that mogul would promise Netanyahu positive coverage on the news site he owned.
Alrighty, so while Netanyahu is facing all these charges, he's also trying to form a government and remain prime minister, right? Such as the outcome of the election 2 weeks back.
Yeah, Marco, like you said, the elections were 2 weeks ago, but that again didn't lead to a decisive outcome. Neither Netanyahu nor his main rivals managed to reach a majority of 61 seats. But what was interesting, if you turn on TV this morning in Israel, you had a real dramatic split screen. On the left hand, you could see Israel's longest serving prime minister appearing in court. And on the right side, you had Israel's president, Reuven Rivlin, meeting at his house with party leaders in his ceremonial role to help set up the government. I don't see how this leads to a government, President Rivlin saying, and he goes on to add that the public is worried that this might lead to a fifth election. I think democracy has run its course at this point, he says, with four elections in 2 years. Now, I just want to point out that despite not winning a majority in the last four elections, Netanyahu has still remained in power as prime minister. By law, the last sitting prime minister stays on until the next one begins his or her term. But if he can't form a stable government himself, and it appears that his opponents can't either, a fifth election would become most likely. And if there are no surprises, that appears to be the most likely outcome right now.
The World's Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv. Thanks very much for the update on the corruption trial of sitting Israeli prime minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
You're welcome, Marco.
Brazil continues to take a heavy toll from the pandemic. In one state alone, more than 800 people are on the waiting list for ICUs. One positive sign, the rate of new infections has started to slow. But now, health officials are hoping that Easter gatherings won't cause a new spike. From southern Brazil, Michael Fox has our story.
This is the soundtrack to the days of Gustavo Pinto. He's a professor of infectology at the Federal University of Santa Catarina and an infectologist at the San Jose Regional Hospital just outside of Florianópolis, Brazil. He's there 6 days a week. He says, I just can't stay home for longer periods, despite having a wife and a six-year-old child, because my head doesn't turn off. The number of patients at San Jose Regional has dropped slightly in recent days, but like hospitals across the region, it's been bordering on collapse for weeks. He says the problem right now isn't just the volume of patients, but the gravity of their illnesses. He says, we did not see this in the first wave. The patients are coming in much younger, and they need much more specialized attention. You can acquire equipment, but you can't sufficiently train professionals to deal with these complex patients in a short period of time. Hospitals across the country are facing a similar reality. 2.5 weeks ago, the Brazilian military set up this field hospital just outside the front doors of the Restinga Hospital in Porto Alegre, the capital of Brazil's southernmost state. The region was collapsing. The hospital more than doubled its capacity, making room for 230 ICU beds. We never imagined a moment like this, says Paulo Scolari, the hospital director. So bad that we might lack medicine to save lives or oxygen. Scolari says they lost 180 patients just in March. He says that number is equivalent to the number of deaths over roughly 6 or 7 months in a normal year. So this really overloaded a lot of people here because death impacts you even when you're used to it on the job. So we're going to try and do a lot of work to try and help people deal with this. He says the hospital is still over capacity, but they now have some empty beds. We believe that in the state of Rio Grande do Sul and in Porto Alegre, the curve is going to drop, he says. All of the hospitals have registered less cases. But researchers warn not to be too optimistic, particularly just ahead of the country's typical fall flu season. Isaac Schwartzopt is a coordinator of Brazil's COVID-19 analysis network. He says, we're seeing increased numbers of people on the streets and rising numbers of people traveling. Some states issued tighter restrictions for the 3-day-long Easter holiday, which ended Sunday night, although President Jair Bolsonaro continues to fight lockdowns.
Usem a máscara. É tão simples, né? A máscara às vezes cai do nosso nariz, vocês fotografam.
Last week, Brazil's new health minister, Marcelo Quiroga, told Brazilians it was fundamental to use a mask and take advantage of the holiday to not get into crowds. But many Brazilians did not get the message. This was Porto Alegre's indoor public market last Friday. The video shared over Twitter shows people squeezing past each other and standing in long lines waiting to be attended. Here's another of a dance party last Friday afternoon at a club in an upscale beachfront neighborhood in Florianópolis. The room is packed. Everyone's holding a drink. No one is wearing a mask.
Todos esses feriados que promovem aglomerações acabam causando...
Health researcher Schwartzop says every one of these holidays that promote crowds increase the amount of mobility. And increased mobility in areas with a lot of infections brings new cases. And those cases bring hospitalizations and deaths. If there is a bright spot on the horizon, the rate of vaccinations tripled in March. Health Minister Quiroga has promised to vaccinate 1 million people a day throughout April. Less than 10% of the population has received at least one shot so far. For the World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Throughout the pandemic, buses, trains, and trams have kept moving in cities around the world. From New York...
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
...to Mexico City...
Próxima estación, Tacuba.
...to Shanghai. Sounds normal, but sometimes those trains were running close to empty. That's a problem that transportation consultant Jeanette Sadikan works on with mayors around the globe. The World's Carol Hills talked with Sadikan about how public transit has weathered the pandemic.
Jeanette, you've worked with mayors in Milan, Mexico City, Detroit, and other places. How has the pandemic affected ridership?
Well, we've seen ridership down probably to the lowest levels in our lifetime. You see Paris ridership is down 30%, London is down 46%, Delhi's down by a third. But, you know, the buses never stopped and the trains never stopped rolling because cities and people never stopped moving. And I think what this pandemic has showed us is that not everybody in cities takes public transport, but everyone is dependent on those who do.
But how safe is it to get on a train or bus right now?
Well, there was a lot of fear early in the pandemic that public transport was a super spreader. I wrote an article in The Atlantic looking at studies of infection clusters in Paris and Austria. And in hundreds of examples, there was no connection found between public transport and any COVID clusters. And subsequent studies found no connections in American cities.
Improving public transportation is a key way to lower carbon emissions. Is this downturn likely to have a lasting effect on climate change?
I think this would be a colossal failure of imagination if success is seen as restoring cities to 100% traffic. And there is a straight line between transportation and climate change. And, you know, when you think about it, there's 1.4 billion cars in the world, you know, and every square inch of pavement, of bridge, of embankment, you know, carries an eternity of costs that you have with building and maintaining and upkeeping that infrastructure. And every square inch that we build for cars just reinforces that use for the next generation, trapping heat and inducing more traffic and creating more pollution. And we can bring back Paris and Tokyo and London and Delhi without bringing back all the inequities.
How do you do it, though, given that, at least in my experience in cities, it takes forever for a new subway line or a new light rail line to be voted on and accepted? It just seems like a big ship to turn around.
Right now, we really have to prepare and defend against the possibility of a car-based recovery. I think that's going to bring cities to a grinding halt. Investing in transit isn't just feel good or good moral action. It's good economics. Active, sustainable transportation is already the long-term plan for many cities. Mayor Kahn's strategy in London was to convert 80% of trips to sustainable modes. But like so many plans right now, his 2040 plan has become his 2020 plan. And I think to put a finer point on it, what we do on our streets has a direct impact on the climate and on the opportunities and livelihood of billions of people.
Are you back on the subway again?
I'm back on the subway again.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
Jeanette Sadikhan is a former New York City Transportation Commissioner. She now consults mayors around the world on transportation systems. She was speaking with The World's Carol Hills. The Pharaoh's Golden Parade. It sounds pretty extraordinary, and it was. Over the weekend, 22 royal mummies were transported from their old home, the Egypt Museum, and reached their new home in Cairo at the just-opened National Museum of Egyptian Civilization. The transfer of mummies? They didn't just put them on a flatbed truck. No. The Pharaoh's Golden Parade was a multi-million dollar event. On Saturday night, downtown Cairo seemed like a set for a Cecil B. DeMille extravaganza. Special dramatic lighting, performers in ancient Egyptian costumes, horse-drawn chariots, and of course, the stars of the show, 22 mummies. The 18 kings and four ancient queens were transported in nitrogen-filled boxes fitted with shock absorbers. And leaving nothing to chance, the road was paved fresh to minimize any bumps. Inside the new National Museum of Egyptian Civilization, an orchestra and singers performed. Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, oversaw it all. Antiquities buff Radwa Roshad watched from her home in Cairo.
Ooh, I have a lot of thoughts. Okay, it's brilliant. Look, the entire premise is great.
But she feels all the theatrics kind of overshadowed the historical details.
It was more the Academy Awards than transferring 22 kings and queens from the Pharaonic era.
Among the queens, Hatshepsut, Egypt's second female pharaoh. Among the kings, Ramses II, Egypt's most powerful pharaoh.
They all have wonderful stories, each and every one of them.
Salima Ikram is an Egyptologist at the American University in Cairo.
But one thing that people don't know so well is the fact that Ramses II is the only Egyptian pharaoh to have been issued a passport.
Yep, that's right. The mummy, not the actual Ramses II, obviously, it had a fungus and had to be flown to Paris in the 1970s for ultraviolet treatment to remove it. These mummies have moved around a lot for restoration, for display, this latest journey to ensure their long-term preservation and give them a home with some permanence. To see the mummies on the march, check out our website, theworld.org. The Turkish band Altin Gun are the past, present, and future of Turkish folk music. They are guided by traditional compositions. They also nod to Turkey's innovative psychedelic sounds from the 1960s. The band also looks for ways to make people dance. It's a psych folk pop soup with Turkish singer Mave Dastemir at the helm.
Her zaman üzersin beni, çok yaramaz çapkın seni, benim Kaç günahım yoktur baştan sen çıkardın beni. Esmerim güzelim tutti dilim ben yanıyorum.
Fusion is not just a sound for Altın Gün. Band members come from different backgrounds, so fusion is also happening in the makeup of the group. Altın Gün formed in Amsterdam just over 4 years ago, so there are Turkish expats, Dutch, as well as Indonesian musicians connected to the Netherlands from the country's colonial history in the East Indies. A mixed crew, but that's not a surprising thing when you try to build a band through social media and dangle the carrot of performing in a modern way the works of legendary Turkish songwriters like Erkin Koray. Here's what singer Mave Dastemir told me.
The bass player Jasper posted this ad on Facebook, said looking for Turkish musicians to play songs of like Barış Manço, Selda Bağcan, and Erkin Koray. And I got tagged in that post via a mutual sound engineer friend of us who is actually currently also our sound engineer. And yeah, I saw that ad and I was like, whoa, okay. This is definitely something for me because I was also looking for other musical projects and I thought it was perfect for me. So that's how we got together, actually, through Jasper's Facebook post.
Social media comes to the rescue.
Exactly, yeah.
So Altın Gün dives into Turkish psychedelia, but you also have a kind of real attachment to Turkish traditional music as well.
Yeah, well, actually, that's simply what we do. We rework traditional folk songs, just electrifying traditionals.
There's a song that you've recently covered. I think it's a traditional song, Kara Toprak. And
yes.
You kind of opened it up. It feels like the Talking Heads, but it's actually a traditional song. Do you remember the first time you heard Kara Toprak?
Kara Toprak is written and performed by Aşık Veysel originally. He's a great, legendary Turkish folk poet. I don't remember the first time I heard it, but my father's from Sivas, actually, where Aşık Veysel is also from. So that sort of pretty much explains our repertoire a little bit. And the lyrics, it means black soil. And it's about, you know, how we get everything we need from Mother Nature and the soil. And in the end, we return to it. It just makes you realize how insignificant your worries are.
Do you know how the band's music is appreciated in Turkey? I mean, do you see sales? Do you know if your music is played on the radio there?
Yeah, we get played a little bit. You know, when we go there, we always have 3 nights in a row sold out shows. So we really have this core loyal crowd there, definitely.
What kind of feedback do you get after those shows in Turkey?
Oh, everybody loves it. It's really different because, you know, we usually tour in Europe or America or other parts of the world. And normally, like here, nobody understands the lyrics and they just feel the music and they really enjoy it. But when we play in Turkey, everybody knows these songs. These songs are incarved in their collective memory and everybody's singing on the top of their lungs. And it's really special to play there. It's quite magic.
I'm wondering there in Amsterdam, how you and the rest of the band think of yourselves as caretakers of Turkish culture.
That wasn't our goal. Like, we never set out to be caretakers or cultural representatives. We like this music and we just wanted to play it live. And it's just very positive.
Mave Dastemir, thank you very much. It's great to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
Mave Dastemir, lead singer of the Turkish band Altın Gün. Their new album is called Yol. As some Turkish expats will recognize, this music works on the dance floor. It could also be the soundtrack for a party in the Turkish countryside. Worth exposing your own ears to the band's sounds. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Gece gelmek gündüz gel, tenhalarda menhalarda buluşalım.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/theworld. That's odoo.com/theworld.
From PRX.